Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. Today, Pittsburgh, like so many other cities, is trying to vault itself into the future again, trying to engineer another transformation, a move from the dirty industrial economy of the Gilded Age to a sleeker, more lucrative knowledge economy. Ted Muller, a professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh, says that looking at life in Carnegie's time reveals both the glitz and the grit of a city on the cutting edge.
If you were a worker in one of the mills, you lived in not very good housing. You lived close to your noisy, smelly, loud, and dangerous mills and factories. And life was precarious because there was no safety net. So if you got injured, the meal ticket was taken off the table for a little while. If you were killed, the family would have to find another means of support relatively quickly. On the other hand, if you were middle and upper income, particularly upper income, life was pretty good. You know, the town was loud. It was dirty from smoke, and the streets are dirty as they were in all American cities at the time. But, you know, life was fairly secure and comfortable, and the wealthy really, you know, usually had two homes, and they usually had a home out in the countryside that could get them out of the smoke and noise clamor.
Pittsburgh, though, was pretty unique when it comes to the incredibly wealthy people who helped shape the city, and I think you could say helped shape America, these sort of tycoons, the Carnegies, H.J. Heinz, Westinghouse, all sort of bumping into each other at the same time. Was there something in the water in Pittsburgh that gave rise to these people who changed our economic landscape, not just in Pittsburgh, but all over the place?
Well, I agree with you. Absolutely correct. These were giants of the day, and there are a dozen or so more that you would recognize. This is really what I think it's about. Research in the late 20th century has pretty much shown that innovation comes from a cluster of small and large businesses in a particular industry. They need to be clustered together, what the academics call industrial districts. Silicon Valley is the obvious, most well-known, but it could be the Research Triangle or Boston's old 128 highway. In Pittsburgh, you had a cluster of things coming together at the mid part of the 19th century. You had an iron industry that was booming. You had an oil industry in northwestern Pennsylvania, in which Pittsburgh was pretty much at the center of, until a guy named Rockefeller from Cleveland came along. You had a glass industry that was the largest in the country. And you put these together, and this was an atmosphere of mechanics, technicians, entrepreneurs who understood that innovation was how to move forward, and they were highly competitive with each other.
You've argued that of all the innovative people in the city at the time, George Westinghouse stood out. Early in his career, he had developed an air brake for railroads. So, I mean, he was creative, of course, right from the start. But why was he so influential, even when you compare him to a Carnegie or a Heinz or a Frick?
You know, he really shares the limelight with Thomas Edison. And I don't think anybody in this country doesn't know who Edison was and that he was the great inventor. And Westinghouse was really right there competing with him all the time. Edison, of course, was in New Jersey and supported by Morgan Capital. Westinghouse created so many things that our country's dependent on. After the air brake, he moved immediately into a whole variety of railroad patents. And remember, railroads were the biggest transportation thing going. They were the most modern thing of the day. He also then, natural gas was discovered around southwestern Pennsylvania, and he drilled in his backyard in the east end of Pittsburgh, hit a well that scared the daylights out of all the neighbors as this big whoosh and flames went up and all. And others were discovering natural gas. The issue, it's not the discovery. The issue is the distribution of it.
Right.
How do you safely get this to homes and businesses and meter it to charge? And that's what he did. And then we can move on, because really the biggest single thing that affects all our lives every day is that he's the guy that showed how alternating current electricity could work and fought Edison and Morgan tooth and nail until the early 1890s, a really nasty, dirty public fight about the direct current of Edison or the alternating current of Westinghouse was safe. And he won it. And
they did have this nasty fight where Edison apparently employed somebody to, you know, speak on his behalf, but it was secret money and nobody knew that he was funneling it. I mean, they used some pretty rough tactics.
Yeah, it would be high media tension today for scandal. I mean, they were like Trump today. You know, I mean, that was no holds barred. Go after each other. Westinghouse is just an underappreciated inventor. And he, you know, he was happiest. He was an engineer, and he was happiest when he was in his own laboratory in downtown Pittsburgh for a long time, where he could just create patent after patent after patent in these industries. And there are many more, but those, I think, are the highlights.
Let's focus in on Carnegie for a second, probably the most famous of all the Pittsburgh entrepreneurs. One of the things he did was leave a tremendous amount of money to the city. So many things are named after him. But part of that, and he said this himself, was that he didn't really believe that the poor could handle their money. So it was kind of better if the rich people said, you know, it should go to a university or a library, and then poor people could enrich themselves by going to the university or the library. Did people resent that kind of attitude in Pittsburgh?
I think it was pretty much consensus. Remember, we're talking about the late 19th century. Carnegie was a social Darwinist. The survival of the fittest, the best would rise to the top, where he took it a little bit differently than most of the other of his social group was that he felt, as you put it, the responsibility of the very wealthy to then use their money for the betterment of society. And he spent most of his last 20 or so years trying to get rid of most of his money. Now, I don't think it was resented here for the most part.
People welcomed the money and didn't worry about the attitude.
Right. But it's that social Darwinist attitude. This is a central problem when I teach a Pittsburgh history course, to be quite honest, is I pose to the students, would it have been better for him to have paid for Carnegie to have paid living wages to his workers and have a safety net? Or was it better in the end for the city to make as much profit as he could, which he did, out of the hides and the backs of these workers and leave all these wonderful things that we, in fact, really enjoy today
right,
in Pittsburgh?
Right.
Carnegie came from a labor family. His father was a highly skilled textile weaver in Scotland and in the first half of the 19th century. And by the 1830s and into the 40s, that skill was being lost to the emergence of increasingly high-tech textile mills.
Right.
He was a defeated man, and Carnegie grew up in that. They came to Pittsburgh to get away from that, and he never succeeded. So when Carnegie in the 1880s and 90s, decides he doesn't want a union and he's going to break them at any cost because they're, in his view, costing him money. The irony is just awful. And he spent the rest of his life making excuses and trying to explain his behavior because he was a smart Carnegie was a very smart guy. He may not have been a lovable, huggable kind of guy from my point of view, but he was a genius in many ways. And he knew what he had done. That, to me, is kind of the rub. And now take the other side of that is the fact is that Pittsburgh has got these wonderful cultural institutions, has a wonderful spirit of donation. The foundations that we have heavily
right.
came out
right.
of those worlds. And for a city of our size today, comparatively speaking, we're muscular in
right.
terms of our foundation endowments. So the legacy is enormous.
Mm-hmm.
how do you sort that out into nice, simple black and white boxes? It's not easy.
It's hard to do.
Yeah.
Ted Mueller is a professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh. Ted, thank you so much for this conversation.
Well, it's been my pleasure. It's always fun for me to talk about these things.